Hi, everyone. Hi. Welcome to the press conference for Downsizing. I'm Alicia Malone, and I'll be your moderator today, and I'm excited to bring up our special guests. So let's start with screenwriter Jim Taylor, director and screenwriter Alexander Payne, star Hong Chow, and producer Mark Johnson. So I will start with just a couple of questions before I open it up to all of you. So while everyone gets settled, Jim, I'm going to start over with you. What was the initial kernel of inspiration for this story?
My brother, Doug, many years ago, he wasn't thinking about a movie, but he was thinking about the environment or thinking about... he was just thinking about downsizing for some reason, and he started to do all kinds of calculations and get excited and talk to me about it, and I kind of nod my head. And then I started to think, maybe that might make a good movie. And then I talked to Alexander about it. This is 12, 15 years ago. And then we got to work.
And I know it took many years to craft and find the story. Mark, at what point did you come on board and what did you think of the script at the time?
I'm a relative newcomer. I think I've been involved for about 3 years, and these two gentlemen to my left have been involved for about 12 years with it. And Alexander and I were working. We've known each other for a while. I had not met Jim before, but we were working. We were developing something and having a pretty good time doing it. And so I think the confluence of events was, he said, "Well, do you want to help us put together Downsizing?" I thought, first of all, the idea of reading a Alexander Payne, Jim Taylor script was pretty delicious. And I was so worried that I wasn't going to like it. And, of course, I loved it. I think the ambition of it is so incredibly strong that I never read anything quite like it. And I think my biggest hurdle, or that I wanted to make sure that I could help Alexander keep it an Alexander Payne film and not let the size or the panorama of it somehow overpower everything else.
It feels like an Alexander Payne film because it focuses on humans and real people. And at the center of it all, you've got Paul. Alexander, what made Matt Damon perfect for this role?
Good morning, everyone. I needed a fantastic actor who I also would believe is an everyman, who looks more like a real human or someone I would know than like a movie star, even though he is a movie star. But then I also needed a movie star who could help bring the financing for the hefty budget we needed. And at his age range, you know, mid-40s, really there's only Matt Damon right now. And he had been kind enough to tell me years past in passing, "Oh, we should work together someday." So I phoned his office and asked for an audience with Mr. Damon. He granted me that. I told him the story of the script. He raised his eyebrows. I handed it to him. He phoned me a week later and accepted.
So you've got the movie star and then the breakout new star.
Yeah.
Hong, tell me about coming on board this. Was this a character that you could relate to easily?
Oh, absolutely. When I first read the script, I was really blown away by all of the incredibly insightful observations about race and class. And it was a story that humanizes refugees and immigrants in a way that I've never seen before. My character, Naglan, was a revelation to me. It's somebody who I feel is very familiar, who a lot of us think that we all know, but not in this way.
Now I'll open it up to you guys. Who's going to question us down here? We've got microphones if you need them, but I think you're close enough.
Yes, okay. Hong, it seems like your part is mildly controversial. People seem to think that the accent is, you know, not real, that it's a caricature or whatever. Can you talk about
situation speaks in the film?
Is that how you feel, or
no,
is that
no, okay? No, I've seen it twice, but I think people have said to me, that's not right.
Okay, sure. Well, when I look at my parents, I don't see a stereotype. I see a human being. I see a full person. It's a little bit tricky discussing the movie because it would require me to explain the entire movie, and I feel that part of the responsibility of an audience is to digest and metabolize and think about the story on their own. But I see that in this particular case, the audience really needs a lot more guidance and explanation. So I'll do that. I'm not quite sure why people are so flabbergasted to hear a person with an accent in a movie. We're surrounded by people who speak with accents. We're a nation of immigrants. And in the city of Los Angeles, in any major city, we have people who work in kitchens, who do all of the labor that a lot of people don't want to do. So the movie shows the machinery, the apparatus, the value system that allows for that inequality, and I don't think that showing it is problematic. Does that make sense?
I'd like to add that we've screened the movie several times now. I've had over 5 or 6 different people come up to me, Vietnamese Americans, and come up and say, "Oh my God, you got my mother exactly right," or "This is just like my aunt." And so it may seem striking to some people, the performance. This is very true, and as Hong said, she really developed it from your family, right?
Yes. I mean, of course, my parents, my community, the Vietnamese immigrant and refugee community that I grew up with in New Orleans is certainly an inspiration, but also, at the end of the day, the character is mine. She's mine. I feel like people don't put certain limitations on other actors. When British or Australian actors come over and they perform an American character, we laud them and we talk about how great it is that they were able to do this other accent that is not their own. And Americans have different relationships with different accents. The way that we view a Spanish speaker from Spain is different from how we view a Mexican person, because Americans have a different relationship with these people. And so with a Vietnamese accent, it's usually because we tend to have occupations where we are in a we're servicing people in some manner, and that brings up the race and class issue and inequality and discrimination. So that's a lot to unpack, and it's not just about an accent being problematic.
Another question down the front.
First of all, I'd like to applaud the filmmakers for having a character that we're not used to seeing. I loved your performance, Hong. It was hilarious. And like I said, it was a refreshing take on a Hollywood movie because we're not used to seeing, like she was saying, immigrants portrayed as the leading ladies, basically. So can you talk about, was that always your intention?
It's interesting because as opposed to other movies we'd made, we really wanted to make this an international movie, and it's an international problem that's being addressed in part, and we're all humans. So we didn't set out to... We only set out to have a character, and then what would that character... what would be their experience, and then how would they react meeting another character? And so same for the Serbian. Anyway, I'm just saying we weren't on a mission, but I'm happy that there's It's interesting to see how different people react to the casting.
We have a question over there.
I'm Devette with Black Girl Nerds. I want to stay on topic.
Did you say Black Girl Nerds?
Black Girl Nerds.
That's great.
Thank you. I just want to talk a little bit more about the sensitive, I suppose, nature of the portrayals of the minorities in the film. I loved your performance, by the way. I thought it was brilliant.
Thank you.
The rest of the color in the film was in the background. And the haves were portrayed who had lines as primarily white and European. There were no haves with lines that were minorities. And I think that's one reason why there was a negative feeling coming out of it, that could have very easily been addressed by having like characters who were major characters of a minority. So that's me. But was there a discussion of this? Was there a choice? Because I have to say, it seemed a little tone deaf.
I would like to speak to that first, actually.
No. I'm first.
I understand that framing of it, but I respectfully have to disagree, because if you say that, you're saying that my character is in the background.
No, I said the haves.
The haves.
Your character is very much a have-not. I'm talking about the haves, the rich, the people with big houses, who your character cleaned houses for. I'm saying there were no characters of that type in the foreground. They were very much present in the party and in the background and that kind of thing. I understand what you're saying. Your character was extremely important. I'm saying to the creators, the writers, and whatever, usually in these types of films, that's what happens. People of color are there to kind of give atmosphere, but they're very much in the background. With no like prominent character, no prominent role was given to a person of color who was a have, a person who had achieved, a doctor.
Other than Niecy Nash.
Well... Yeah.
Well, I would like to say that something that I responded to very strongly in the story is that we're showing that inequality, and we're not the people of color who were at the apartment complex where I lived in Londra and sort of my side of what people were thinking was my side of the story. We're not there to prop up the white male character and show him in this great positive light. If anything, we're showing that he's a part of the problem because he's not paying attention. And I don't see anything wrong with that.
It's a really interesting question because for storytellers, filmmakers, or whatever, because it wasn't unconscious, really. And a lot of times, I mean, the reason, I think the motivation behind wanting to see those characters as described is to change the world, is to make the world a better, more equal place. And I think that we, for better or worse, were trying to write a movie that was reflective of the world as there's when I said we weren't on a mission to write in Hong's character, it's really true. We're just trying to, I guess I'm saying we have a choice of writing, reflecting the world in its unfairness and inequality, or to create a sort of move the world forward into a place that's more equal and more, and I think we don't subscribe to, we're not filmmakers that are setting out to do that. We're setting out to reflect what we see and the problems we see.
I think there was a question down here, yes.
Hi, Mr. Payne. I was wondering, when you write the character of Holmes' character, why you chose the personality of demanding and bossy, but also funny? Because most of the Asian characters portrayed in film are usually quiet, reserved, not talking too much. I just wondering about the inspiration of the personality of that character.
Well, her background is as a highly motivated firebrand dissident who motivates others and rallies others around her cause with some degree of monomania and huge amount of energy and telling people, you know, organizing people and telling them what to do. And that's that's where that came from. You know, she's a ball of fire, that character.
I got one down the front.
And a survivor.
Hola. Morning.
Hi, good morning.
I agree with you, Han, and everything you said. I think people are recreationally outraged these days. I find that the social political satire in this movie is more than adequate and fantastic. Very refreshing. And in that setting, everything in the movie was on point. So, having said that, going back to your character, full of funny one-liners. Was that you? Was that on the script? Did you ad-lib? Were you allowed to? How many takes did you ruin or pump up?
Well, a lot of it was in the script, and that's what I loved. I could not believe that they came up with this character, because I think a lot of us are really struggling with how to tell these really important stories about people. And most of the time when people think about a refugee story or an immigrant story, they immediately think it's going to be really sad and depressing. I remember when when Beasts of No Nation came out, and I loved it, and I saw the movie, and I was trying to get everyone afterwards to watch the movie. I was like, this is a great, amazing movie. This kid, Abraham Atta, is so amazing in it. And people would tell me, oh, it's really, it looks really depressing. I don't want to watch it. So that's also something that we need to think about when we're trying to tell these stories about very difficult issues that a lot of people feel really uncomfortable with. One way of doing it is to just humanize them. And part of being a human is also laughing and having you know, immigrants, people of color, we have senses of humor. We laugh, you know. I think if when I read the script, I didn't see it written stereotypically. And hopefully if I did my job right, she shouldn't come across as a stereotype. And I think it's okay to laugh if someone you love says or does something peculiar. My parents make me laugh more than anyone, and they also make me cry more than anyone. And I love my character, and I feel like the writers love her. So hopefully the audience will love her too, and if they are laughing, it's out of deep affection and none of the other things that people are saying. Thanks.
Can I just, I read, so I haven't been reading a lot of press, but somebody said, oh, it's a white savior story. And I thought, what? Where'd they get that? She saves him. Anyway, I thought I'd throw that in.
Yes, question down here.
Mr. Payne, if you'll pardon the pun, I want to look at the big picture real quick. Do you see this, when you were making it, as a tale of an optimistic tale, as humans we will find a way to save ourselves, or as a sort of a cautionary tale of no matter what we do, we're going to screw ourselves in the end?
I prefer the latter.
And I prefer the former.
We have a question down there.
Oh, okay. I know a script writer in real life that's writing a story about a man that lost both arms from the elbow down. So I'm very interested in how you guys pulled her leg situation off. And it looked, it was so real, I was expecting her to come here with a half leg.
Yeah.
So could you tell me, was there special effects, or how did you guys do that prosthetic thing?
Thanks for asking that question, because we put so many hours of effort into making her, I mean, because we have the visual, I've been getting a lot of questions about the visual effects and creating Leisureland and having it in Norway and big and small, and very few have asked about the huge amount of work we put into making a prosthetic leg convincing on screen, particularly in one shot. I mean, the amount of man hours put into one shot when he returns to her apartment and learns that the poor lady Gladys has died, and she says, okay, now it's time for you to fix my leg. And in one shot, she walks across the room, sits on a champagne cork stool, and slips off her prosthetic and holds it up. That was a big damn headache, that shot, to get it right. For her part, Hong can tell you she spent time. We found a couple of amputees. One amputee we worked with was born that way, and another one was an amputee in Toronto. So we had kind of two people. We also had one of the amputees be, let's say, a stump double in a couple of shots. But Hong was trained how to walk, how to move, what parts of your body are used to accommodate for the missing limb and that sort of thing. And then with many of the shots, she would be wearing a green sock and something, you know, completely green from just below the knee down. And then we replaced it photographically, digitally afterwards. Do you want to add anything?
No, that sounds about right.
I want to add something. I'm sorry.
I'll just finish what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Another thing that I really loved about playing this character was, and I don't think that this is something necessarily that the writers, I don't know, we've never talked about this, but for me as a Vietnamese person and somebody who is from Southeast Asia, that region has experienced a lot of violence in its past, and so it's symbolic for me to see a woman who is an amputee.
And I just quickly, I was just going to say about the craft of sometimes at award shows and stuff, people will say, oh, and the whole crew and blah, blah, blah. You know, to be there and see the artistry that goes into the making of the prosthetic and the visual effects and the people that do this that most people don't, it's a real privilege to interact. And we haven't done that much work like that. And anyway, it's exciting.
Yeah, question down there.
And it's if I could just tack quickly onto what my partner just said. I'm getting compliments, of course, about the visual effects and to the visual effects designer, supervisor, and to the production designer. But also with regards to the prosthetic and making all that work, and throughout the film, we had a magnificent property master.
Mm-hmm.
Magnificent property master.
Dave Gulick.
Dave Gulick.
Hi there, good morning. First of all, I have to say I'm very disappointed because there are no Italians in the movie. You know? And second, the real question is, now we live in a post-joke society. We are obsessed with politically correctness. Does this phenomenon make your job as a director easier or more difficult?
You're talking about what people would say are politically correct police or something like that. It can't affect what we do. We just have to do what comes out of us, what we think is, as always, honest, funny, dramatic, and surprising, and truthful.
And human.
You know, which is that we try to be sensitive human beings, both as artists and in our lives, you know, as much as possible. But you know, I don't know what else to say. If we're just honest to ourselves, we have faith in that.
In the middle there, just here.
So I'm from Sweden, so I of course have to ask how you found Rolf Lassgård, and also how come you chose Norway as this.
Oh, a jealous Swede. It's exactly the problem. Exactly the problem. We thought who would come up with what progressive people would come up with this crazy but sane idea to save the human species? Well, probably Scandinavians. And then we said, okay, probably either Sweden or Norway, and we landed on Norway.
Yes, and the seed vault is
correct.
Part of that.
And the seed vault inspired the entire Act 3, where they were going to get, like, that now that they've already done that with seeds, they could also hide tiny human beings in the permafrost for a few thousand years to protect them from, you know, nuclear holocaust or whatever, that life will survive.
And the seed vault flooded recently.
Yeah, they had a flood a few months ago.
Yeah.
And you ask about finding the brilliant Rolf Lassgaard, Mark Johnson, and I wanted to hire Norwegian. I always liked the real thing. I liked the real McCoy. And I would have been... enjoyed hiring Norwegian actors all to play Norwegians. However, like Norwegian cinema, we had to go to Swedes to sometimes find actors to play Norwegians. Stellan Skarsgård plays Norwegians all the time, for example. Mark Johnson and I were having a dinner in Oslo with a big producer there named Jan Jakobsen, and we explained to him whom we were looking for. And he said, well, the greatest actor currently in Scandinavia, the new Max von Sydow, if you will, is Rolf Lassgaard, who has never given a bad performance. We didn't know who he was. And we looked him up, and then Rolf is always busy doing, you know, he works all the time, but finally he was kind enough to put himself on tape, you know, with an iPhone, reading some of the words of the screenplay, and we knew immediately he was the right choice. By the way, there's a crazy woman toward the end of the film who comes running out. She's also Swedish, Margareta Pettersson. Originally, I had Liv Ullmann to play that part. What happened was that the film fell apart, as it had done a couple of times. It fell apart yet again. When it coalesced a year later, I approached Miss Ullmann again and said, we're ready, and she said, well, I'm not.
Well, was she directing?
She was directing something at the National Theater in Oslo, and she had some a personal issue. Of course, I'm not going to ask her what it is. So we decided to find someone who actually was the crazy woman who I was going to ask Liv Ullmann to play, and it was this Swedish woman.
I wanted to ask you about the whole issue of global warming, which, you know, this film deals with. And I don't know if there are actually any scientists out there that are working on downsizing people, but, I mean, for your, you know, in your own universe of, you know, traveling the world and, you know, making films on location and so forth, what are your thoughts about what we can do as a society to, like, dampen that, aside from, you know, making people 5 inches tall? I mean, what are your own thoughts on it? Because, you know, Jim, I imagine you have some ideas about, you know, global warming and, you know, the environment when you're writing this. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, and we co-wrote, you know.
Co-wrote,
yes,
yeah.
Yes. There are a lot of things.
Get Trump out of office.
Yeah, you know... I don't know if I can speak to that. So, I mean, I could say that there's a whole range of solutions. It's funny, I was at the Gotham Awards in New York, because I live in New York, and Al Gore was there, and he was very upbeat and positive about the possibilities and stuff, and I want to believe him, but, you know, what he's saying is there are solutions. And we just need the political will to implement them.
And the acceptance that it's happening. Nobody's going to do a goddamn thing until people say this is really happening and it really is going to come to an end. You know, to actually accept that, not think, oh, it's interfering with how much money I'm making. So acceptance is the first thing. Scientifically, though, I have no idea. I'm no specialist. I don't know anything about it.
Another question down here.
I just have to ask. How many takes did it take to do the scene with Edward?
Oh, gosh. You would remember better than me.
It was about eight. She was already... Look, let me just say, first of all, the take where she says, Jesus gives me a good gift, I go Norway too. One take. That was... She did that. That's take one. Best shot in the film. The love F scene... I think we did about 8 or 9 takes. Not that each one wasn't terrific. The great thing about Hong is that each take is truthful, each take is different, like the great film actors. But I was looking to be able in the editing room to pitch the performance a little bit this way or not, you know, how teary she would become, how much she would steel herself. So everything she did was great, but she was kind enough to let me manipulate her a little bit this way or that, so I would have some freedom in the editing room.
Let's settle on 8 takes, all right?
Good question over there. Hi, this is Wendy from Surrey Chai Thai newspaper. So thank you for mentioning Thailand in the in the movie. So you will get the Thai crowd for sure. And I have questions for like downsizing. You know, from the movie, it's like, you know, about financial crisis. You know, people want to get more from what they have, and also you mentioned about like global warming, about, you know, help saving the earth. Which one is your inspirations, or both?
I think it's the two of them together. I think if we had thought, oh, this is just going to be about getting small and as a way to combat climate change, that wouldn't have been enough for us. But to think, oh, see, this immediately becomes something that's perverted and exploited, and then it's interesting. So it's hard to separate the two.
We also didn't set out at all to make a global warming film. We did set out to make a film...
Climate change.
A film that has some political and social satire, like our first two films, Citizen Ruth and Election, had. We had just made Sideways, and we had a moderate success with that. And as a director, I had the urge to do something a little bit more ambitious, and I thought, well, it's only polite to do something with a bit more, you know, political or social consciousness. And then when we were thinking about Doug Taylor, Jim's brother's idea about getting small, the thought was, well, how actually would that come into existence? I mean, if that were really real, how would that happen? Well, probably as a conceived as a solution for overpopulation. Well, who would probably think of that? Scandinavians, Norwegians. And then once we had that, we saw that it was empowering us with a kind of large net to hurl over many elements of contemporary society that we wanted to comment on. Not in a heavy way. We're not heavy political filmmakers. We're satirists, but, you know, hopefully with a political or social consciousness, I guess.
We have a question on the side here.
Hi, good morning. I'm Mikey Hirano Kolaros from the LA Japanese Daily News. And, yeah, I know. So, what? Looking at me like, it's true, you know.
Talk about a stereotype.
Yeah, stereotype.
Talk about a stereotype.
Exactly. The question actually is for Ms. Chow. I'll have to say, I'm not trying to butter anyone up, it's been a long time since I've seen a movie in which someone just steals every scene that he or she is in. And I didn't realize I was here to be a cheerleader. But at the same time, you know, I came today more or less expecting to hear from you a little more Bayou LaBattery. So, I'm thinking about you acting with the accent because the range was so broad, and then you're doing an accent at the same time. And I'm just wondering, where on earth do you find the ability to show that much range and still stay in, you know, somewhat of a caricature, not much, but I'm sorry if that's not the right word, but a character, that's a better word, perhaps.
Ooh, I'm not sure if I'm understanding your question.
you're doing this role, and you're laying on this very thick accent,
mm-hmm.
which, having grown up around a lot of Vietnamese people where I grew up, I can attest is extremely authentic. But at the same time, you're having a show, you know, you're crying, you're laughing, you're bossy, you're making jokes, you're, you know, all of these things you're doing with and staying in the accent. And how on earth are you keeping it up through the entire project?
Well, really, I wasn't focused too much on the accent. I was just trying to be a person. And, you know, we have three white men on this stage. Each of them speak in a very different way. They have different personalities. So I'm not trying to base my character off of an existing person or just one specific Vietnamese individual that I have encountered in my life. That's part of being an actor, is creating something. And that's what I was talking about earlier when I said, she's mine. You know, Gary Oldman is playing Winston Churchill in The Darkest Hour. Is that Winston Churchill? Or is that his version of Winston Churchill? He, as an artist, has an ability to make creative choices and create a character, and nobody really questions him on whether that was an authentic portrayal of Churchill. And for me, because of certain conversations that we're having at large as a nation, there are certain limitations that are being put on me as an Asian actor. Everything that we're talking about, this is basically what I hear back. I hear, oh yeah, sure, you can play music, but you can only play it at this volume between the hours of 6 and 8 p.m. on the fourth Thursday of every month. That's what I'm hearing.
Well, you do such a good job, and we have to wrap it there. And so please thank the cast and crew of Downsizing. Thank you for coming.
No, thank you. Thank you.